And we will go on to case number two. And that case is Appeal 102340, Owner-Operator Independent Association versus the United States Department of Transportation. Good morning, Mr. Cullen.
Good morning, Your Honor.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. And you? May it please the Court. My name is Paul Cullen, and I'm here representing the petitioners. With your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Petition is here, child.
You know, forgive me, but you had, and don't use this as his, don't use what I'm saying. You had reserved 5. Have you changed your mind on that?
I'll take 5.
Okay. I'll give 5.
The petitioners are challenging the final rule of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, which requires the installation of something called an electronic onboard recorder on commercial trucks. That recorder is used to conduct surveillance of drivers for law enforcement purposes.
So, Mr. Cullen, can I ask you some technical questions about these recorders? Because I think it would help me get a better idea of the degree of privacy, intrusion, and the like. Suppose we have an independent truck driver who's got his own truck, and he works a little bit for, say, Home Depot, and he works a little bit for, you know, somebody else, Macy's. He works for a few other companies. And every time he starts with a new client, as I take it, with these recorders, he inputs a new set of codes indicating what company. Is that right?
That's theoretically correct, but as a practical matter, you generally have people working for one motor carrier or one private carrier like Home Depot or something. It's not typical that a driver would change from carrier to carrier, company to company, on a weekly basis or
well, but
like
I'm
that.
Just the reason I'm wondering about the possibility is now the next stage of my question is, suppose this hypothetical driver decides to take the month of July off and spend it with his family. And I want to know, is there some way he can code in to the EOBR, I'm not working for anybody right now? Or does the EOBR think that you're always working? I know there's a difference between off-duty and, you know, sleeper berth and on-duty not driving, that kind of thing. But is there some way of telling the thing, I'm just on vacation? Or does it think you're always working?
I think under Rule 395.16 of Part Code of Federal Regulations, Title 49, the driver could affirmatively enter a notation before he begins to move that he's on a personal conveyance. He could do that.
And you think he would have to do that every day in my hypothetical of the month, every time he decides to drive his truck somewhere? Maybe, again, this may be a little bit fanciful, but I'm just trying to figure out to what extent, when he's on personal time, it's still monitoring him every second, and to what extent he might have some range of personal time where he's really not accountable to anybody.
I would find it unlikely that that would happen over a period of a month, but
probably
if he's using the truck for a personal conveyance, he would annotate that, but he's still got to account his time. If he's driving down the highway and they pull him over, he's still got to demonstrate that he's in compliance with the hours of service regulations, and he could say, well, I'm on my own time now. I'm not hauling for anyone. That's kind of a gray area that I don't think is specifically covered other than this annotation. Whether he can shut the recorder down and drive around without the recorder on, I don't think he could do that.
I think their tamper concern would suggest that, too. But now the final question, then I'll stop for a minute, is how the data collected by this EOBR, or how who it gets transmitted to and how often. So when he's on personal time, is the carrier that he's working for still getting this data every 60 minutes or whenever he does a change in status, or is there some way when he's off duty that it just stores and doesn't transmit? How does that work?
Certainly when he's driving on duty, it's reported regularly, and they have to have 7 to 9 days.
Kind of more driving on duty, it seems to me the state has, or the agency has a very strong interest in how long he's driven and all the rest. But when he's on his personal time, is it still doing the same thing, and is the carrier that he's contracted with still collecting all this information?
I don't know the answer to that over a 30-day period. If he were on vacation and driving around.
Even a week's vacation. You know, you see where I'm going with this.
Yes, I do. Yeah, right. He's got a satellite device that's transmitting the information, a Qualcomm device that is somehow tied into the electric onboard recorder. So in theory, they could continue to watch it.
And so the recipient, you know, the receiving entity for this satellite device is somehow controlled by the carrier?
It is.
Okay.
It is.
I've been wondering about this. Isn't the use of this EOBR, I'm a Luddite when it comes to this stuff, so, an incremental improvement in the sense that it automatically records actual driving time in a way that isn't subject to manipulation?
The driving time must be in compliance. The real question is, does it record compliance with the hours of service regulation? Driving time is only one element of what you need to do to comply.
With actual driving time being recorded electronically, I mean, isn't it reasonable to suppose that it will at least be somewhat more difficult for a driver to manipulate other categories, you know, of data? I mean, doesn't that make sense?
That is what the government suggests, but the answer to that is that you can gain suspicion by looking at a paper log just as easily as you can gain suspicion to look at other forms of backup information from an EOBR.
But I think the question really is the just as part of your statement correct. Because when the government says there are these four categories, and when you can manipulate all four of them, that puts you in one position. When you can only manipulate three of them, that incrementally makes the job of manipulating harder. It would raise red flags more often. Agency rules aren't supposed to be perfect, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to say, if you've got a mechanical and accurate record of miles driven, that would reduce the opportunities to game the system. It doesn't eliminate them, of course. I certainly take your point on that.
Let me give you an example. A driver begins driving at 6 in the morning on Tuesday. If you don't know whether he had 10 hours of off-duty time prior to that, you don't know whether the first minute of driving at 6:01 is compliant.
But at least
if you drive 11 hours, you don't know whether that first 11 hours is compliant. You might know if he drives 11 and a half hours that the last half hour could not have been compliant.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm.
But that's a very small increment.
And over time, you know, over 6 months, 12 months, 2 years of having the EOBR, seems to me cumulatively you would begin to get an idea of whether even that first hour was compliant.
I don't think so, because the violations are issued on a trip-by-trip basis.
Well,
you go down the road and you're pulled over by a state trooper, and he looks at your EOBR and it says, well, you've only driven 8 hours. you're fine. But it doesn't tell him that he was up all night repairing the truck and then loading the truck
and
didn't get his 10 hours before he started off.
What came before the EOBRs? That doesn't either.
It doesn't. That's correct. So there's no incremental improvement.
Why does he care about getting a pass from the trooper? He cares about the trooper who says, your EOBR says you've already driven 11 hours. I'm reporting you for it.
That's the only incremental improvement. If you drive 11 hours within 14, it will tell you when you go over the 11 hours. But the overwhelming amount of time on the road recorded by drivers is within that 11 hours, and it tells you nothing about that. It tells you nothing. And looking at it after 6 months, that doesn't deal with day-to-day compliance, the practical necessity of day-to-day compliance on the road.
But sure it does over the period. I mean, you want to know over the periods of time. It's very helpful. It's like any other any other studies that would go on as to whether or not something is working or not.
Same study, Your Honor, is easily conducted with paper logbooks as well. There's no reason why you couldn't say, well, it's very suspicious that it's never taken him more than 20 minutes to load and unload.
But this is a new world, Mr.
But you could do that with...
Not a new it's not a new world to the driver who's out there every day, and it is the duty of the agency to demonstrate to this court that there is a need and that this particular instrument will solve the need. They cannot demonstrate that because there are two intimately associated problems. You must measure driver time, and most importantly, he has got to have the time available to get sleep.
You know,
that doesn't record that, and you could have sleepy drivers out there for 11 hours a day.
You know, something that we haven't zeroed in on is that the new rule isn't a blanket requirement that all carriers install these, but, you know, rather a limited requirement that applies only to carriers with a real history of safety violations. We've got a pretty narrow rule, certainly a lot narrower than the one that was adopted in 2003. And, you know, I realize there's no hard and fast evidence that data that EOBRs will reduce accidents, but it's certainly possible for the government to rationally conclude that their use will improve safety by making it harder for drivers, you know, to evade the statutory limits on the numbers of hours spent on duty. And now that I've given that speech, I want to go into driver harassment.
Yes.
I want to get us there, if you don't mind.
If I might make one comment, the D.C. Circuit criticized the agency in Public Citizen in 2004, and it found that just because it was facially plausible for EOBRs to help, it doesn't mean that they actually will help. This is at 374 Fed Third.
There's no doubt that this case is closer than Public Citizen.
And the same criticisms made by the court in Public Citizen, they said you should have studied it. And 6 years later, they propose EOBRs, and they never studied it. All right, going to harassment.
Well, you say that the agency never made any provision regarding driver harassment. It appears that the agency, however, did try to accommodate privacy concerns. And isn't there, wouldn't you concede, I know you lawyers hate that word, but wouldn't you concede that there is a substantial overlap between the two concepts?
Absolutely not.
Oh, ha, ha.
Take a look at 42 U.S. Code 2000EE-2, small e.
Do it again.
42 U.S. Code 2000EE-2. That is the privacy regulation, and it is crystal clear that that regulation deals with the collection, use, and disclosure of information by the government. It has nothing to do with driver harassment by motor carriers who use the information garnered from an EOBR to harass drivers and to force them to miscode on-duty, not driving time when the truck is being loaded or whatnot into off-duty time.
Why couldn't a motor carrier bent on this kind of harassment of its drivers, as a voluntary matter, meaning not compelled by government regulation, say, our fleet is going to be equipped with EOBRs and do all of these terrible things? You know, why is the regulation what makes this harassment possible? There are certainly some carriers that voluntarily have installed these devices over the years.
There is a statutory requirement that the regulation deal with it.
I know, 49 U.S.C. 31137A.
And I don't understand quite your question.
My question is, if you think that these devices are going to enable harassment, that's what I don't see, because it seems to me a carrier who wants to, I mean, sorry there are such carriers, but a carrier who wants to harass its drivers just has to say, in our company, these are installed, and it can harass away. So I don't know why the regulation creates more harassment than that company would have engaged in.
The issue is, isn't it that the regulation should do something to prevent that from happening, like imposing penalties if carriers do it, requiring state or federal officials to examine harassment if it's present, providing rights of drivers to prevent harassment and to prevent retaliation for drivers who complain about it. There are a lot of possible approaches, but the burden of the statute is on the agency to put something in the regulation to deal with precisely that problem.
And
they should have, and they didn't.
Why does the use of these EOBRs or whatever they're called, why does that change the potential for harassment? You're concerned, I take it, about companies which make drivers manipulate their, not driving, on-duty, not driving time. Why can't they do that with the paper records just as well as they can do it with the EOBRs?
They can do it better with the EOBRs because they have a real-time input that the truck is stopped. It's been stopped for 2 hours. The driver still has 3 hours of time left where he could be driving, but he's too tired. And the carrier gets on the Qualcomm device and harasses him. Get out of bed and get moving. You got 3 more hours. And he's too tired. That's harassment. This regulation should deal with it. That privacy analysis.
You're concerned about the problem where the records are accurately kept, but the driver doesn't want to drive. And because the owner-operator is getting the data, he calls the driver on the cell phone and says, get working?
That's right.
Why isn't that a productivity issue?
To the carrier, it's productivity. To the driver, it's harassment. He's too tired to drive, all right? And the carrier wants him to drive because it'll increase the carrier's profit and help deliver more loads. And the man is exhausted, and he can't drive safely, and the carrier is pinging him on the device saying, get up and drive. That's harassment.
Is there any case law or any regulatory pronouncements that show us where the difference is between productivity, which is a proper concern, and harassment, which is improper?
The statute tells us that you can't have harassment, and the agency should help us with this, and they provided no help at all. They should have addressed it. We put stuff in the record on harassment. No comment, no nothing. And then it was an oops.
This is what you mentioned in your reply.
Yeah. And who here doesn't doubt that this privacy statute, which they now cite, is a last-minute effort to cover up a major oversight? And under public citizen, this and this alone is enough to overturn the statute.
Who? The man that's coming up right now. Come on up.
Thank
Mr.
you. I'll
serve
whatever time I have for it.
Okay.
Well, you've got your first issue to deal with, don't you?
Yes, and Mr. Waldman, I very much wanted you to deal with
yeah.
that because just to add one more thought to the mix, the agency uses the word harass exactly once in that long and relatively boring thing from the Federal Register that we read through. And you might come up with great arguments in your brief, or we may come up with even more brilliant arguments from the bench, but we're not allowed to rely on a rationale that the agency didn't itself rely on. This is a very familiar standard of administrative law. So I'm not sure how we can construct a harassment argument out of bits and pieces here and there in the various studies the agency did.
And forgive me, but I'm going to add something to that, because this might be helpful or might not. But bottom line, is there a distinction between driver privacy and driver harassment?
I think I can answer the questions best by starting with your question, Judge Roebner, if that's okay with you, Judge Wood. I think that there's a significant overlap between those two concepts, although they're not necessarily identical. I think the best way to start with the question of what does harassment mean in the statute is to look at the text and the context of the statute and see what Congress was very clearly not talking about when it was talking about harassment. The first is the introductory clause quite clearly contemplates that the Secretary will issue a regulation that deals with these types of devices, what are called monitoring devices, and that they will gather data used to ensure greater compliance with hours of service regulations. And the data that these devices and the rules require go directly to hours of service compliance. And so Congress here was very much contemplating and not prohibiting a collection of a certain kind of data, data that had a direct and reasonable relationship to hours of service compliance.
Right, and then you go on in 31.137A, and you see this command for a balancing. The regulation shall, normally understood to be mandatory language, ensure that the devices are not used to harass vehicle operators. However, the devices may be used to monitor productivity, which Judge Gottschall was talking about.
Right.
So I looked in vain, maybe I just zoned out, but I looked in vain through that Federal Register statement and the various other, you know, the regulatory impact statement and everything else. I couldn't see where you defined the components of harassment. I think it's something, you know, privacy is vis-a-vis the government, privacy is vis-a-vis the carrier, privacy could be, for all I know, vis-a-vis the general public. You know, tamper-resistant stuff. And harassment, at least as Mr. Cullen is defining it, is something that really flows from the, I'll just call it employing, I know a lot of them are independent contractors, but the employing carrier to the person. Where's that discussion?
Well, I think one of the problems here is the first time it was ever alleged that that harassment is something entirely different from the privacy concerns that the agency addressed was in the reply brief. So the agency never had an opportunity.
No, because the reply brief cites the comments on harassment.
That's correct, but the comments were not.
That's a non-starter. Let's.
I think what the agency was doing is all throughout its rule was saying we are addressing, and this is in the privacy impact statement most directly, but it's in the rule as well, we are going to make a very conscious effort to balance, on the one hand, the need to for greater compliance with hours of service regulations, which is exactly what Congress is talking about, on the other hand, ensuring that the data that's collected through these devices is not of a nature that unduly intrudes into the private lives of drivers in a way that doesn't really bear any relationship to hours of service.
Look, however big an overlap between privacy and harassment may be, it is certainly possible to imagine ways in which EOBR data could be used to harass a driver without intruding on his privacy, and I suppose the best example is one that the petitioners cited, you know, an employer using the data on drive time to insist that a driver get back on the road. But, and that scenario has absolutely nothing to do, it seems to me, with the driver's privacy. He or she is required to log this data already, but the prospect of an employer using electronically recorded data to ride the backs of his, drivers is a plausible example of harassment, and I don't see where, so far, but I'm sitting here with bated breath, where the government has shown that harassment itself was considered, nor have you pointed to anything in the regulation,
Your Honor,
that prohibits the harassment.
All of the types of harassment that are illustrated on page 9 of the reply brief are and were already prohibited by the regulations of the agency. It is already a violation for a motor carrier to call up and tell a driver, you need to keep driving even though it would not be in compliance with the hours of service. And certainly the agency is entitled to say, we don't need to have a device that duplicates, prohibits what is already prohibited in our regulations. In fact,
isn't there a paragraph or explanation that says certain forms of harassment were drawn to our attention in the comment period. Here's why we didn't think it was necessary to put something in this regulation. Again, maybe this wouldn't have been too hard for the agency to do, but I don't see that it did it.
Because
you can't have us parsing one statute with another statute and saying, well, you know, we can look back, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't...
That's not statutory construction. Because I think what the agency is thinking is, the complaint here is harassment comes from collecting data about your duty statuses.
Well, and I think what to give the petitioners their due, I think they're saying in the world of paper records, people wrote their records down. Let's assume the overwhelming majority did so honestly, and afterwards maybe they'd get chewed out for taking a 3-hour break instead of a 1-hour break, but that was the most. Whereas this constant electronic stream coming from the EOBR, whether it's every time there's a change in status, every 60 minutes if you're just driving, but it's not necessarily only at 60-minute intervals. Yeah, it could be more frequent. Gives a tool to harass that the
Your Honor, I think you're striking at the heart of it, and petitioner said something which I think is absolutely inaccurate and is important to understand. The impression that they give in their briefs and that they stated directly is these devices are required by the agency to give streaming real-time information to motor carriers, and then there's someone's at a desk looking at it and calling up the driver. That's not the case. The only thing that's required by these rules, and I cite you to, this is 49 CFR 395.16M. It's in the...
Say it again.
49 CFR 395.16(m). It's in the appendix to their opening brief at page 41, if you'd like to look at it right now. And my understanding is, if you are not currently under remedial order... you have 13 days to give your information from the EOBR. If you are under a remedial order, 3 days. So there's nothing here required where you have to give information immediately to the motor carrier, then they're on the phone with you. Now, there are EOBRs that are not required by this rule.
Say the page again. I'm sorry.
41. 41, Your Honor. If you want me to, I believe it's in the middle column. If you want me to.
Right down toward the bottom of the middle.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
And this is part of the rule. So we're not talking about, and I think it's very important to understand that our understanding of the statute, and I think it's clear from the face of it, is that what's required is that the devices the agency imposes not be used for harassment, not that something that somebody voluntarily adopts and that once the agency has a standard, everybody's got to throw out what they've been using for a decade or more.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. This gets back to my original questions. These devices must, at some level, record constantly, you know, every time the vehicle's in motion, and then make a, you know, have some sort of electronic notation when the driver puts in, I'm, you know, on duty, not driving, or whatever the driver inputs. And so I remember reading somewhere that the, let's say, the startup information that the EOBR has includes, you know, the carrier, some sort of identifier, however that's done, you know, by number or something of the driver, and a few other things. So are you telling me that there's a way to put into this EOBR an indicator that you're not driving for anybody right now? Or does it always think that you have to have a carrier?
Well, you can certainly, there's a way to annotate your records, and I think you could put that in. But with respect, I think the hypothetical really doesn't occur in the real world. If you're saying your example before about taking a month off and doing your own personal thing, ordinarily a driver has their own car, and if they're taking a month off, they're going to be driving that, and they're not going to be driving their truck around. Suppose in theory that they did. The fact that you're on your own personal time doesn't mean that you can go around driving this truck 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just because you're on your personal time. And certainly, if you were driving...
Because it's the truck that's the regulated thing?
Yes, and because the driver's under an obligation not to drive when they're fatigued.
Right.
And also, if you were driving, say, a couple of hours for your personal use before you went to work for the motor carrier you were officially on, you still would count those hours towards whether or not you were at your 10-hour limit or whatnot. You could, it's not as if you say, I'm punching my time clock and everything that happened the second before that no longer counts. That's just not the way the regulations work. But if I may, I'd like to just touch on a couple of other issues, unless you had further questions about the harassment. The only thing I'd like to say about that before we move on is it's important to understand that the way the agency deals with this, in addition to assuming a whole bunch of regulations that preclude the very type of harassment that petitioners are talking about, is stemming the flow of data that would be very private in nature and precluding it from getting to the motor carrier. Or not requiring it to get it to the motor carrier, so that other kind of private information would not lead to different types of harassment as well.
The information from the EOBRs goes only to the owner, the owner operator, the carrier. Is that correct?
Well, it goes to the agency as well.
And it goes to the agency as well, simultaneously to both.
I don't know. It's not as if it's sort of automatically recorded. I think you have to. Some of them are wireless. Some of them you can plug in, and I don't. I know that, as I said before, there's a certain number of days that you have to get it to the motor carrier.
Is it like when I send an email, I can put two addresses in there and hit send, or I can put one address? Is it that kind of transmission, or is it something else?
I think you can do it wirelessly. I think you can plug it in. You could take out a memory card, so it's not necessarily simultaneously. But I will say I'm not exactly sure of the technical specifications.
Forgive me, and I'll give you an extra minute for, you know, stupid questions from me. Is someone sitting there in a government office monitoring this at the very time?
No, I think what happens is there are roadside checks where your data is checked, and then if there's a compliance review, someone will go through your records of the last 6 months. But it's not as if there's a bureaucrat sitting at a desk in real time or even a day later checking everybody's. I mean, that would be too large of a bureaucracy. That would be impossible to do.
Do we know anything about what harassment means in the context of this statute? Is there case law? Is there anything?
No, there's no case law. There's no illuminating legislative history. I think the only thing that we have is that Congress said, number one, it can monitor productivity, and number two, it can collect data that's relevant to increasing compliance with hours of service. And I think that's one of our main points is clearly it contemplated this kind of data collection. If you couldn't collect data on changes of duty status and how long you were in it, the devices wouldn't do anything. So it's our view that Congress had to have this kind of thing in mind.
And let me ask one other question. I saw, of course, concern in the explanations about ensuring that the devices were tamper-proof. So
mm-hmm.
I take it it's not possible for the driver himself to disable the device.
That's correct. That's the way they're designed. Now, I can't say that it's impossible for someone to hack into something,
but they're designed
to be tamper-proof. And one of the things that the agency said in 2003 is we weren't that sure about the tamper-resistant qualities, and now we are. But one of the things that I'd like to speak to is the ripeness and standing of the petitioners, because that's obviously a threshold issue.
Before you get there, is one of these people from any state anywhere near the Seventh Circuit? Why is this case here?
That's a good question. The venue provision in the Hobbs Act says you need to have your principal place of business or reside.
In the judicial circuit in which the petitioner resides or has its principal office, or in the D.C. Circuit. Well, we're obviously not the D.C. Circuit. I thought OIDA was in Missouri, which last I checked was in the Eighth Circuit.
Right. I'm not exactly sure why they brought it there. There's also some individual petitioners, and I can't recall specifically where I saw it in the record, and perhaps they can address it, but I thought one of the individual petitioners resided in the circuit. And certainly it's a venue question, which is waivable, and we haven't addressed
it. We're wondering why we have the privilege of...
Yeah, why we're so lucky as to have you all here.
Maybe you can ask the petitioners why they chose the circuit.
Because they knew we'd be the panel.
But, here's my problem with your ripeness standing argument. I mean, this is... a challenge really to the rulemaking. It's not a challenge to any particular enforcement action, and I feel confident that if they had waited until 2012 or thereafter and had complained merely when a particular driver or company was under a directive, you would have said, you've waived the opportunity to challenge the basic structure of the rule.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. It's long been, my understanding, long been black-letter law that in an enforcement action, the subject of the enforcement action can challenge the underlying rule or regulation that authorizes the enforcement action. And that's why, for example, if there's a long-standing regulation, and you weren't born at the time within 60 days under the Hobbs Act of when that regulation was enacted, you can still challenge the underlying regulation in an enforcement action. You still have to comply with the Hobbs 60-day rule from the time the remedial order is finally issued.
But you can also bring pre-enforcement challenges. That's been clear since Abbott Labs.
Sure.
It's true if the case is ripe because you have a direct, immediate, adverse day-to-day effect.
Right. Yeah, but you've got all the petitioners here participated in the rulemaking process. The owner-operator association, as a trade association, certainly has members who will at some point be required to install these.
They're trying to nip in the bud even the beginning of the installation of these EOBRs, as I understand it.
Right.
As opposed to just waiting
sitting there.
I understand, but what they have to do today is exactly what they had to do the day before the regulation, which is comply with hours of service.
We want to see them the day before the regulation.
Understand also, first of all, when you said they will certainly have to install these, that is all not only 18 months down the road, but contingent on, one, will they get a compliance review? Number two, will they have a 10% or greater violation?
Does the record show... over the last several years, what percentage of people subject to these hours of service regulations have had this 10% or more violation? It could be everybody in the industry, or it could be 1% of the industry. Do we know?
I don't know what percent of the industry. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think...
Apparently the problems have been rampant with this rule, so I'm wondering how broad the sweep really is.
Well, I'm sure it's in the record, but I don't know the answer off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm sorry, but.
But I guess that makes some difference to me in terms of the pre-enforcement challenge, because if companies effectively can see the handwriting on the wall, they're going to start installing these EOBRs, let's say with the shadow of this regulation hanging over them. They're going to want to be.
Well, right now, many companies already have for years voluntarily installed EOBRs for their own efficiency reasons. And, of course, this rule encourages companies to voluntarily install them now. But remember, if 18 months from now, if you get a compliance review And if it shows 10%, you still, under the regulation, have 45 days to install what is in an off-the-shelf product, which doesn't take much time to install. And you could have an administrative appeal of the remedial order in which those 45 days are stayed, in which your requirement to install it immediately. So it's not like there's some Damocles sword hanging over you.
But what they're going to want to say is no one in the entire industry should have to have this. Again, it's this across-the-board, if you will, challenge to the whole concept of an EOBR as opposed to paper.
Well, it's entirely speculative whether they would be required to do it under this rule. They have to do.
Some people will probably be required, though. And this is a association that represents, I mean, it's like Washington State Apple Advertising Commission.
I'm not familiar with that commission, but...
There's a case. Hunt versus Washington State Apple Advertising Commission that says a trade association has standing to pursue litigation when a substantial number of its members
will
are going to be
affected.
Right. I think if you had, it might, I don't know the facts of that case, but it might be a different situation if this imposed a new requirement. But the requirement at bottom here is to comply with hours of service, which is exactly the same requirement as before. It's just a new consequence to the same situation, a consequence that's entirely speculative.
One that they said the Fourth Amendment.
Right. How much is in the OBR?
Oh.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I wondered.
I guess my red light is on.
I thought you were very slow on the draw over there, but I wasn't.
Sorry, Your Honor. My red light's on. Would you like to answer any questions?
I want to know how much an EOBR costs. I want to buy one.
I think it's spelled out in the regulatory impact assessment. I think it's maybe a couple $100 for the lowest cost compliant one.
Companies that make them?
I think there are quite a few companies that make them. The technical specifications have changed in this regulation, so the manufacturers will sort of keep up with that. But
no, I don't want to break your heart, but I think you got some extra time. How much extra time? 1 minute? Oh, that's okay. Do you want to say something, or I'll give you an extra?
I think I'll just, if the panel has any questions, I'd be happy to address them on the Fourth Amendment or arbitrary capricious, but other than that, I'll...
You'll go away.
You've briefed everything.
I've briefed everything. If you don't have any questions on it, I'll be... Okay. Thank you.
So much. Okay, Mr. Cullen, you get an extra minute, so how much time does Mr. Cullen have? You have 3 minutes.
3 minutes can be an eternity.
With us, yes.
Yes.
On the incremental benefits, the respondents don't contest our analysis of the trip out to California and back and how many 41.5 hours of the 66 hours of driving time were in fact not in compliance. Of the on-duty not driving time, it only recorded 3.5 hours on the electric onboard recorder manual entry, and yet there were 20.25 hours of on-duty not time. These are serious problems, and the EOBR does nothing to correct them. The goal of the regulation is to improve compliance with the hours of service regulation. The defendant can show no improvement, and they have admitted that in our 28J letter, which I'll call to your attention again, in a notice of proposed rulemaking that was issued just a few days ago. EOBRs will have limited effects on improving accurate recording of overall daily on-duty time because of the 14-hour rule, or weekly on-duty time because of the 34-hour restart rule. And that also applies to the 10-hour rule. You've got to get 10 hours of opportunity to sleep before you get on the road. The only incremental improvement is that you can be certain if someone drives longer than 11 hours that the excess over 11 hours might be in violation. You know nothing more because of the on-duty recorder, electric on-duty recorder, as to the first 11 hours. You have no way of knowing whether that's in compliance, no better way of knowing than with paper logbooks.
Do you have any information about how many of your members might be affected by this regulation?
They're all potentially affected, but until we know how many carriers violate the rules...
How many carriers get violation notices or whatever?
I don't have any information on that, and the record is silent on that. The record is also silent. There talks about widespread noncompliance. If you look at 75 Fed Reg, which is, I believe, the final rule, 75 Fed Reg at page 17211, second column, it says, and I quote, "It is still not possible to determine the level of noncompliance." All right? There is no baseline against which to measure. Now, when you're talking about incremental benefits, remember that under the statute, they must show a cost-benefit analysis. And a little bit just isn't enough when you look at the substantial intrusions into driver privacy and the substantial cost. That 1 hour you pick up from 11 to 12, that is not enough to satisfy a cost-benefit analysis. And it certainly isn't enough to justify the substantial intrusions. We didn't get into the Fourth Amendment, but as you know, there is a...
Don't worry about it.
I've been trying for 20 years to get a Court of Appeals to look at the Fourth Amendment in this area, and we commend that to your attention on our briefs.
I want to just thank you, Mr. Cullen, and you, Mr. Waldman, for a really well-argued, well-briefed case. We're grateful for that. Thank you. So, and thank you. And have a good trip back to Washington, both of you.
Minnesota, before Washington.
And be grateful that you can get out of this town today. And the case will be taken under advisement. And thank you for coming here.